This afternoon, on behalf of Harvard Bookstore, I'm pleased to welcome journalist John Cassidy for an examination of his latest book, How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities. In How Markets Fail, one of our leading business journalists takes on the global financial crisis, the current recession, and a host of economic theories to explain how we got where we are today and how we need to correct misguided thinking in order to get us out. Kirkus, in a starred review of the book called How Markets Fail, quote, an elegant, readable treatise on economics swathed in current headlines. Cassidy delivers on the promise of his title, but he also offers a clear-eyed look at economic thinking over the last three centuries. He shows us how the major theories have played out in practice, often not well. He writes with terrific clarity and a finely tuned sense of moral outrage, yielding a superb book. John Cassidy has been a staff writer for The New Yorker since 1995, writing on articles such as the current economic crisis, Alan Greenspan, and the Iraqi oil industry. At The New Yorker over 7 years ago, Mr. Cassidy authored an article there entitled The Greed Cycle, How the Financial System Encouraged Corporations to Go Crazy. Previously, he was a Washington bureau chief, then business editor at the London Sunday Times, and deputy editor of the New York Post. Mr. Cassidy's first book, Dot Con, How America Lost Its Mind and Money in the Internet Era, was published in 2002. I'm so pleased to have you all here with us today. Please join me in welcoming John Cassidy.
Thanks very much, everybody, for coming out on a actually quite pleasant winter afternoon, and thanks very much to Harvard Bookstore for inviting me here. I've been thinking about writing a book on how markets fail for many years, but my wife always put me off saying nobody's going to buy a book with that negative a title. It turns out she may be right, we'll see. But after the financial crisis of a couple of years ago, I thought I should really just sit down and write this book. I mean, after all, there are so many economic problems out there, from, you know, inequality, poverty, repeated financial crises, global warming, urban blight, you name it. You know, there are lots of problems out there which rarely get addressed in straightforward economics books of the sort I learned economics in, and I'm sure some of you did. So I thought, you know, there is definitely a market there for a more skeptical view of the economy. And then it seemed to me that the financial crisis itself provided a sort of historic example of markets failing. There have been various explanations put forward for what happened over the last couple of years. I would say there are probably three or four of them. The most common one, from the man on the street's perspective, I'd say, is that it was all criminality and greed. Sort of Madoffism writ large, you know, a bunch of greedy Wall Street bankers took the economy down with them. Second theory which has been put forward is that this was some sort of mass psychosis, sort of outbreak of collective insanity. Some very respected behavioral economists have sort of made this suggestion that, you know, a lot of psychological traits involving herd behavior and collective irrationality, which help explain this. People in the housing market forgot the idea that prices could ever go down. People on Wall Street turned a blind eye to the risks, etc. It was basically an exercise in a sort of crowd psychology at work. The third theory that's been put forward, mostly on the right, is that this was essentially a government failure. There are various forms of this theory. The most common one is that it all goes back to the government intervening in the housing market back to 1979 in the Community Reinvestment Act, and then during the 90s, the Bush administration, and during the 2000s, the Clinton administration, both put pressure on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the other agencies to buy up subprime mortgage securities. So the argument is ultimately it was the government distorting the housing market that there was the problem. They're the three main theories, I think, of what happened. I don't think any of those is particularly persuasive. I think there's an element of each of them. None of them is completely untrue. Obviously, there was some criminality. We've seen people being sent to jail for criminality, and probably should more of them should probably be sent to jail. And clearly, there was some sort of overconfidence and what economists now call disaster myopia. So psychological factors did play a role. The government, I think the government role has been exaggerated. I think it's a sort of way out for the right and people who defend the free market. It gives them an excuse. They say, oh, well, you know, it wasn't the market after all, it was the government. But if you go and actually look at the studies, they show that only about 10% of the subprime mortgages had anything to do with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They didn't buy any of them, or they didn't buy any more than that or guarantee them. This was overwhelmingly a private sector phenomenon. 90% of the subprime securities were originated by private companies, sold on Wall Street to private investors. So it was a private sector phenomenon more than anything else. So I don't find that persuasive either. My theory, as I say, as I've already said, is that this was basically an enormous market failure and a failure of ideas, really. Ultimately, a failure of misapplied free market ideas. So the way I sort of frame it in the book is I start off with Alan Greenspan, who came to be the sort of apotheosis of this free market ideology over the last 20 or 30 years. Start off with him appearing before Congress this time last year and admitting that he did have an ideology and that it was a free market ideology. Obviously, anybody who's read any of my stuff would already know that, because I've written extensively about his sort of links to Ayn Rand, etc. But he said, look, everybody has an ideology. This was my ideology, and in this instance, it failed. I relied on the self-interest of the bankers and other people in the financial community to not get us into this sort of mess. The argument was, you know, financial markets are self-regulating because it's in the interest of bankers to avoid the sort of blow-up that we've had. They basically would do a good job managing risks. Greenspan said, I believe that. It served me well for 40 years, but it ultimately failed. So you got to my book is an attempt to explain why it failed. And I, apologies, the way I do this is, as I say, seen as ultimately a failure of ideas, I try and trace this free market ideology. Where did it come from? What does it miss out? And then how can we explain the crisis through it? So the first third of the book is actually taken up with a history of free market thought, going all the way back to Adam Smith. Like many other people who studied economics in college, I managed to get all the way through undergraduate school and graduate school without actually reading The Wealth of Nations, although everybody always pretends they've read it. But if you actually sit down and read it, you find out it's sort of 1,200 pages of pretty dense prose, and there are a lot of short summaries you can read. But I actually thought, well, I better go back to the source here and actually read it. So I read it pretty much from back to front, and I came away actually with a lot of admiration for Smith. I think the basic free market idea, there's a lot in it. This is not a book saying, you know, we need to abolish capitalism or free markets. I think Smith explained in two or three very pithy ways why free markets ultimately probably do a better job than any other system we've come up with for just creating wealth. I'm not saying they're very good at distributing wealth, but just creating wealth. First one is the division of labor, which Smith talked about, the pin factory. Those of you who are familiar with it, if you get one guy to try and make a nail, sorry, an American phrase, pin or a nail, I always get mixed up. I've been in America so long, I don't know which words are British and American anymore. But anyway, he called it the pin factory. You know, if you get one worker to try and make a nail, it might take him all week. If you get 20 workers all doing, specializing in one of the individual tasks, such as cutting the metal, sharpening the end, attaching the head to it, you get an enormous increase in productivity, and a few people can make tens of thousands of nails in a week. It's obviously a very simple example, but the division of labor spread across the entire global economy has produced enormous productivity growth. Not just the division of labor, the other aspect of free market, which Smith identified, and which again I think is true, is that you get rewarded for success and punished for failure. Not always. On Wall Street, it doesn't necessarily work out like that. You often get rewarded for failure there. But in general, if a business produces things, a restaurant produces meals, people want to buy a hotel, you know, provides a good service, they do well, they make profits. If they do badly, if they produce shoddy goods, they go out of business. That's a very simple feedback mechanism, but it's actually something which is lacking in most other economic systems like feudalism or socialism or communism. So if you put those two things together, the feedback mechanism from the profit motive and division of labor, what you get is this incredible productivity growth machine. Again, if you go back to the sort of early 19th century, people were very worried about, you know, mass starvation. Malthus, people think he was, you know, how can he possibly thought that at the time? But lots of people thought that at the time, because there was no sign of this incredible burst of productivity growth that we've had since then, which is the basis of, you know, basically modern civilization, I think. So free markets, as I say, I think, basically good for producing wealth. We've seen that in recent years, through the shift in India and China towards free markets. You know, I think the latest World Bank figures are that 600 million people since 1995 have been dragged out of poverty in those two nations. Now we can argue about the poverty, what the poverty limits are and whether they're too high or too low, but it's beyond doubt that there have been enormous economic growth in both of those countries, and a lot of people have been taken out of poverty. So that's sort of two strikes for Adam Smith. But what I also discovered in Smith, which I hadn't realized, is that he was actually very skeptical of some elements of the free market, especially bankers, which for some reason I'd never seen referred to anywhere. He actually has a section where he describes a local bank in Scotland where he was from, which lent too much money to all the local businessmen, lots of local businessmen, then went out of, lots of the local businessmen were just having shimmy-shammy status schemes which didn't have any basis to them. They went south, they couldn't repay their loans, the bank went bankrupt, and threw the entire local economy into a recession, which, if you think about it, is exactly what's happened on a sort of global scale in the last couple of years. So Smith said because of that, even though he was in general against, in general in favor of laissez-faire, leave the market to the market's own devices, he made an exception for banking. And actually, I'll read a quote from him, which, as I say, sort of shocked me when I read it. He said he favored banking regulations. He said, such regulations may no doubt be considered as in some respects a violation of natural liberty, but these exertions of natural liberty of a few individuals, which might endanger the security of the whole society, are and ought to be restrained by the laws of all governments, of the most free as well as the most despotical. The obligation of building party walls in order to prevent the communication of fire is a violation of natural liberty, exactly of the same kind with the regulations of the banking trade, which are here proposed, but it is equally justified. So there was Smith basically making an argument in 1776 for quite strict financial regulation. What happened, I think, after, he also made arguments for the government promoting public works and defending the country, but that they're pretty well known. The financial regulation argument, I don't think, is very well known. So I started out with Smith. What I do is sort of try and explain how his ideas, which I think basically were quite sensible, were sort of perverted over the course of a couple of centuries. I won't go into details, but taking you through the growth of what economists call general equilibrium theory, which is very boring and dense, and then the Chicago School, which is a bit less boring and dense, so I'll spend a bit of time on that. Milton Friedman. If you go read Friedman, which I also did, you'll see that he actually says most of these ideas are in Adam Smith. I'm just regurgitating them. But I think what he did, Friedman did, and his followers, is they took them too far. There are two specific examples of this, which again are quite complicated. But there's one theory called the efficient markets hypothesis, which is basically the financial markets always get things right. The second theory, called the rational expectations hypothesis, is the hypothesis that everybody's smart enough to sort of foresee the future or systematically foresee the future, and they don't make errors. Those quite complicated mathematical theories took over a lot of economics in the sort of 60s, late 60s, 70s and 80s, and had a lot of influence on policy. The whole idea that that financial markets are self-regulated and can be left to their own devices, the intellectual underpinning of that idea is this Chicago School efficient markets theory. So I spend a bit of time explaining that. And then in the second third, I call utopian economics. It seems to me it's not largely based on reality, it's based on a utopian view. The second third of the book, I then switch and try and trace an alternative sort of economic history of economic thought, what I call reality-based economics. The idea that markets can fail in various ways is not a new one, not a new one at all. As we saw going back to Adam Smith, he said, you know, the banking sector can fail. But throughout history, or throughout the last 100 years, also a lot of economists, many of them who taught across the road, have also come up with various theories of how markets fail. I start off with just a couple of examples. Global warming. Most people don't think of global warming as an economic problem. They think of it as a technological problem, or maybe a geographical problem or something. I guess not geographical, mainly technological. But actually, it's basically an economic problem. And what's the economic problem? It goes back to an English economist at the start of last century, Arthur Cecil Pigou, who came up with this idea of economic spillovers, which is the idea that what happens in one market can affect what happens elsewhere. The example he used was of a, it was obviously the early 20th century, was of a railway setting up, say, between New York and Boston. That provides a lot of valuable services to the people riding it, and that determines the prices of the tickets they charge, etc. The private benefits of the people riding on the train are reflected in the price system. That's all well and good. Problem is, what about if in those days there were steam trains? What about if the steam train's going through the countryside, which I just came through this morning, and sparks fly off it and set the whole local woodland or local fields ablaze? Who bears the cost of that? The local farmer or whoever it is? It's the cost of the spillover from the railway's activity is not incorporated in the price system is the basic problem. That was a very small example, but it's actually very profound, because what it says is that private markets are very good at balancing private costs and private benefits, but very bad at balancing social costs and social benefits. And that's what we have in climate change. All the people who are burning the greenhouse gases, power stations, SUV owners, etc., they're paying the full cost, the full private cost of their activities. You know, they have to buy the fuels, etc. The market does a good job of reflecting the private costs. But the social costs of their actions, i.e. the, I'm assuming for now that the scientific consensus about global warming is correct, the social costs in terms of rising temperatures, which are going to be borne by future generations, the private market misses those out completely. So what Pigou said was that what we need, the way to address that is to basically use taxes. He called them extraordinary restraints, but it's basically a way of correcting the market failure by forcing the polluters, in this case, to pay some of the costs of their business. Obviously, if they face quite high taxes, quite high carbon taxes, they're going to cut down on carbon emissions. So that's a form of market failure and a solution there. There's lots of other forms. Lots of them have to do with information problems. In healthcare, for example, another topical example, what's wrong with healthcare? Well, there's obviously a lot wrong with it, but two things that can be traced to sort of basic economic problems. One, there's an informational asymmetry. The people buying coverage, if you go out and try to buy coverage on an individual basis, you know a lot more about your healthcare, your health record, than the company does who you're trying to buy the policy from. They therefore suspect that you're either chronically ill or have a good likelihood of becoming chronically ill if you're out there trying to buy individual coverage. Very hard for you to persuade them that's not the case. So as a result of that informational asymmetry, corporations who are in the business of making profit from selling health insurance are very reluctant to take on individuals at reasonable cost. That's the basic reason why private insurance for individuals is so high. They fear that, you know, the risk pool of individuals is going to be very tainted, and they basically try all they can not to offer individual coverage. They'll only offer it at an extortionate rate. On the other side of the market, that's one informational problem. The other side of the market, there's an issue of moral hazard, which is another piece of economic jargon. But basically that means is that once you're insured for anything, you don't have any incentive to worry about the costs. And that's essential to any insurance system. Think about healthcare. Once you've paid your health premiums, or somebody else has paid them for you, if it's employer-based, as most of us have, or the fortunate ones do, we have very little incentive to worry about the costs of treatment. So, you know, if you have a headache, you go to the doctor, he says, well, I think it's just migraine. You say, well, it might be brain cancer. How about getting a scan just in case? And the doctor's not paying for it either, so he'll probably go along with that. Turns out, you know, this sort of system, you know, we get massive overuse of medical resources and massive cost inflation. They're both economically driven problems, both forms of market failure. So we've got global warming, we have healthcare, two of the big issues of the day, and of course the financial crisis. So the third part of the book, the second part of it, I go through a sort of history providing some of the famous economists who've come up with various theories of market failure, Pigou. I also focus on John Maynard Keynes and Hyman Minsky. And this goes to my sort of theory of what went wrong in the financial markets. How are we doing? About 5 minutes? My basic theory of what went wrong is that it was what I call rational irrationality at work. What does that mean? It means that the people involved in the subprime industry from the start of the chain, the people who were taking out mortgages, right through the people who issued the mortgages, to the Wall Street firms who were securitizing the mortgages, to the credit rating agencies who were rating the bonds, to the investors at this end of the chain who were buying the securities. All of those people were acting quite rationally in their own self-interest, given the incentives they faced. So from an individual basis, it's rational, I argue, but it adds up to collective insanity. We get an enormous property bubble, an enormous credit bubble, which bursts and plunges the global economy into biggest recession since the 1930s. So it's collectively irrational. So that's the idea, rational irrationality. You can trace this idea back. It's not the phrase I may have come up with, but the actual idea itself is actually quite an old one and goes back to Keynes, as I say, who compared a lot of investing and activities in the financial markets to beauty contests. This is a bit of a sexist analogy, but England in the 1930s was sexist. In those days, they used to have newspapers, used to print pages full of photographs of pretty girls, and it was a contest. You wrote in and said who you thought was the prettiest, and if your choice was the most popular, you won a prize. So how do you play that game? Now, if you were a neoclassical economist, what you would do is you would look at the women and decide on the basis of, you know, how they look, who's the prettiest. But actually, that's not going to win you the prize. What you have to think is, which woman is the average opinion going to think the prettiest? So you're thinking about how other people are going to play the game. And then if you're really smart, you think, well, I'm not just going to think about how average opinion who's the prettiest. You've got to think about what average opinion thinks that average opinion is going to be the prettiest. And then you can have an infinite recursion, as Keynes said. Some people play it to the fifth and sixth degrees. It's ultimately, instead of the whole free market idea is that people buy stocks, bonds, whatever, on the basis of fundamental values. And if things move out of whack with a reality or with the economic reality, arbitrages come in and push prices back to their proper levels. That's the efficient markets hypothesis in a nutshell. What Keynes said and what some other people at Harvard actually formalized in the 1990s, including Larry Summers, although he seems to have forgotten some of it since then, was this idea that it can be rational to surf the bubble if you're an investor. Rather than, if you think you're a hedge fund or just some rich guy trying to make money, which the two of those things are essentially the same thing, when you see the stock market going up and you think it's overvalued, you have a choice. You can either sell out now, you know, and try and push the prices back to reality, or you can say, well, chances are this looks like it's a bubble forming. People are getting excited about it. It's in the papers. Much smarter to buy in now and then sell out before the fools find out. They had a name for this on Wall Street. It's called the greater fool theory. And, you buy and then sell to a greater fool. And I think it helps explain a lot of what was happening in the market. Seems to me the Wall Street banks weren't stupid and they weren't necessarily evil. Just given the incentives they faced, it was very difficult for them to stay out of the market. The example I cite is Citigroup, which is now a basket case, obviously. But from 2000 to about 2005, Citigroup actually acted quite responsibly. It wasn't a big player in subprime mortgages. It did have a small subprime division, but much smaller than all of its rivals. But that caused it problems because this market was incredibly profitable for years. So all of its rivals were making big profits. Start of 2005, the board of directors came to the chairman of the company, Chuck Prince, and said, look, Chuck, we're falling behind. We need to increase our risk profile, get into some risky areas. That's where the profits are. You know, we can't be left behind. Now, what could Prince have done at that stage? He could have said, look, Citigroup is just too august, too great an institution to risk the entire future of the company on issuing loans to people who basically can't afford them. It's all going to come a cropper. But that really wasn't an option for him because he was already under pressure because they were falling behind everybody else. And B, he was incentivized with these enormous, as is everybody else on Wall Street, with these enormous stock options packages. So all he really cared about, quite rationally, was getting the stock price up for the next few quarters. In that sort of environment, the rational thing to do is to go with the herd and join in. It's almost impossible to stay outside. We saw that in the technology bubble, about which I wrote my earlier book about the stock market bubble with the analysts. There were a lot of analysts on Wall Street who thought that these internet stocks were crazily overpriced. But by the time the bubble burst, almost all of them had lost their jobs because telling the investors to stay out of the market was a terrible business decision for the individual firm, because they would just move to their rival. So basically, there's this sort of inner logic of the market which drives it to craziness once you get a speculative episode going, is my argument. Then at the end of the book, having sort of laid out that argument, I try and say a few things about what should be done about it, and I'm happy to take some more questions about this. But there are two basic points I'll make. Number one, whatever regulations you set up or whatever system you set up, the fundamental need is for a sort of intellectual counter-revolution, I think. We need to overturn this proposition, which somehow has been entrenched for the last 20 or 30 years, that the market always gets things right. I think, you know, the market sometimes gets things right, and sometimes does a very good job, but, you know, there's a big difference between sometimes and always. So there just seems to be, as I say, in Washington especially, when you talk professional economists, they say, well, we always knew about market failure, of course, you know. But they didn't do a very good job of telling the politicians about this, because whenever you, especially in the financial sector, trying to argue against the Greenspan line was very, very difficult, as I found out myself for 10 years or so. There was just a sort of intellectual consensus that the market got things right. So I think that's what we basically have to change, and this book is an attempt to try and contribute to that change. And the second thing is just we have to, whatever the policies are introduced, they have to take account of incentives. The whole problem is that the market sometimes gives bad incentives. Adam Smith, Milton Friedman, Friedrich Hayek were completely right when they said the essence of free markets is that the prices act as signals and people react to incentives. Where they got it wrong, I think, was in saying that the price signals that are sent out are always the right ones. Friedrich Hayek, who I wrote an article in New Yorker about years ago, famously called the market a telecommunication system, and the prices are the signals. And I think he was exactly right. The problem is that the signals, as I say, sometimes are the wrong ones. Once prices depart from reality, the signal they send to people is that you should join in this insanity rather than trying to correct it. That's not just on Wall Street. We see that in the housing market, for example. Once house prices start rising, you know, I've done this myself, you know, we start getting jealous of our neighbors who are making quick killings. And the temptation is, you know, join in. There's easy money to be made. So it's very difficult to overcome that. So I think any form of regulation or new laws which are introduced, you know, have got to take that into account. It's no use just saying we're going to ban this, that, or the other. These guys on Wall Street and other places are smart. They'll come around with ways to game most regulations. We have to think carefully, you know, how it's going to affect the incentive structure. That's pretty much it. As I say, I'm quite happy to take questions on any individuals, what Obama's doing, what the Fed's doing, as anything more sort of concrete. The book, as I say, is mainly a battle of ideas, but I do have views on a lot of more specific things. Okay, I'll repeat the question. The question is, does Ben Bernanke deserve reappointing as Fed chairman? Cassidy votes yes, he does. Why is that? I think Bernanke did a terrible job between 2005 and 2007. He basically followed Greenspan's policies. He was one of the architects of the credit bubble. He made the argument back in 2003, 2004 that you know, he should keep interest rates low, that the real problem was coming from China. They had an excess supply of savings, so that was why interest rates were low. It wasn't the Fed's fault. That was the rationale the Fed used for keeping interest rates too low for too long. That kept mortgage rates down, caused the speculative bubble from which everything else flowed. So Bernanke failed the midterm, I'm afraid. But I think he did pass the final. Once they realized that the entire financial system was in danger, he basically threw the old rule book out the window and tried a whole series of what for the Fed were quite controversial things. The idea of reducing interest rates and pumping money into the economy, that was just standard sort of Fed practice. But all these special lending programs that he introduced, which actually turned out to be quite effective, they hadn't been tried before. So I think he did a reasonable job of sort of preventing wholesale calamity. And I think the other thing is, I think he deserves, so he did a bad job, then he did a good job, you would say, well, it's 50-50. The reason I think he deserves reappointing is I think he is actually sort of repentant for the past mistakes, and I think he is determined to introduce some regulations. I think he wants it to be his legacy as the sort of Fed chairman who cleaned up Wall Street a bit. Now, he might not be able to do that, but I think given that he did a good job over the last year or so, we should give him the chance. The question is, why does it make individual sense to participate in the bubble? Is it because you can get in and out before it bursts? The answer on an individual level is yes. Most people think they can. Obviously, if everybody tries to get in and out at the same time, the bubble collapses. That's what happens at the end. But there is a period. There is a period in which you can get in and out. Chuck Prince actually was go back to the chairman of Citigroup. The FT interviewed him a couple of years ago before the bubble burst and said, you know, you're taking big risks. Things are looking a bit shaky. Are you going to pull back from these markets? And he said, no, as long as the music's playing, we have to keep dancing. And what he was saying was that basically investing or Wall Street management is a form of musical chairs. Which Keynes had also said. Actually, I don't know if Prince was directly quoting Keynes or was just channeling him. But that's what it is. Once one of these bubbles get going, it is like a game of musical chairs. And as you know, if you play musical chairs, you know, you can get the seats that are there available for some of the time. So a lot of people made a lot of money on the upside and got out in time. Same in the technology bubble. A lot of the hedge funds surfed the bubble quite skillfully and got out before the bust. So that's why I think it is rational on some level to participate as an individual. I mean, it's easy for Warren Buffett to sit out the bubble because he's already a billionaire. You know, another billion here or there doesn't really matter to him. If you're a Mexican immigrant in East LA and with a very low paying job, and suddenly you have the chance to buy a home for $300,000 with zero down, you're basically being given an option by the bank on the rising housing market. Seems to me, you know, they're giving you a 90% loan plus a 10% piggyback loan to pay the equity. What are you risking? You know,
Charles Prince is rich.
No, Prince should have done. No, I agree. He should have done. You're right. But whether he would have been the chairman of Citigroup when the bubble burst, I don't know. He would now look like a hero. I agree. Fidelity is actually an interesting case because at the same time the contra fund was sitting out the bubble. I learned this in my last book. You know, Jeff Finnick, who was managing the Magellan Fund, went heavily into tech stocks, and then Stansky after him, who took over, also went heavily into tech stocks. And I mean, I think that was basically the end of the Magellan Fund, right, when it collapsed in 2002. So you know, sure, sensible statesmen should stay out of the market, but I think what you find is, you know, there aren't many of them around once the bubble really gets going. It's a very good question. I mean, when I said that Bernanke and the Fed did a good job, I don't mean they got everything right. I think they gave Wall Street, the strategic choice to bail out the banks was the right one, just because we tried going the other way in the 1930s, and we also tried it with Lehman Brothers, and you know, things didn't look very good, and they certainly didn't turn out very well in the 30s. So the option of just, some people in Chicago still do think we should just let the whole system collapse and everything would have been fine in a few weeks. Maybe they're right, but I'm glad we didn't run that social experiment, because as I say, to some extent we ran it in the 30s, where the Fed allowed bank after bank to collapse, and didn't work out very well. But the question then is, how do you bail out Wall Street? And there I think Treasury and the Fed both, they deserve a lot of the criticism they've got, because they had a lot more leverage than they realized. The banks were prostrate at that stage. Goldman was about to go out of business. Morgan, they all were about to go out of business if they couldn't raise money. We, the taxpayer, were providing them a lifeline, and we should have charged them a lot more for it than we did. So I think that's a legitimate argument. The banks are now repaying their loans and they're claiming, well, we gave the taxpayer a good deal. They made 10-20% on their investment over a year. That's a completely fallacious argument. At the time they got the TARP money, they couldn't raise money anywhere else. The implicit interest rate they would have faced was sort of infinity. So 10 or 20% is nothing. The Fed should have said, what they did in England, basically, to be fair to the British government, I think they took a much tougher approach. They said, sure, we're going to bail you out, but the taxpayer is going to take 60-70% of the bank, and we're going to hold on to it for a long time. So if the shares come back, you know, the taxpayer will benefit. So I think that's, you know, that's it. I think we should have bailed out Wall Street, but I think we should have been a lot tougher about it. What Bernanke and Geithner especially say is that at the time it was just such a big crisis, they didn't know what they were doing. You know, things were happening so quickly, it was all snowballing. I think that's a bit of a cop-out. You know, I think they could, especially in the AIG case, the famous AIG case, where they agreed to pay everybody out at par on their CDSs. Sorry for the jargon, but they basically just agreed to bail out all the people who were in hock to AIG at 100%. I think they could have easily, you know, given them a 50%, for example. And it turns out that Goldman was one of the big beneficiaries, so that's caused all these conspiracy theories. I just don't know the answer to whether it was a conspiracy, but it was a bad financial decision by the government, I think. Well, to some extent. I mean, I think what he's referring to probably were various things which weren't in place, which Frank's legislation and the Obama legislation do put in place. The ability to wind down big banks, the FDIC didn't really have the big commercial banks, they could do it, but Lehman Brothers or Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley. No, right, but there are various ones. So they didn't have that capacity. That's why they had to bail them out. They couldn't. There wasn't a sort of special bankruptcy provision, which the government, a government-controlled bankruptcy. B, in terms of the regulatory oversight, you're right, there were large elements of the financial system which were just outside the regulatory system, derivatives being one example, but also mortgages largely weren't regulated either because they're regulated at the state level, and the state regulators are completely overmanned. In California, I think there were like, I think there were 11 regulators regulating the entire mortgage industry, you know, and that's where most of the big mortgage companies like AmeriQuest and New Century and Countrywide, they were enormous in California. And the reason they incorporated there was just because they realized that the state legislation was so weak. So that will change under the legislation. Mortgages will be overseen by this new Consumer Product Safety Commission. So I think that's a good idea. Derivatives, they go some of the way towards regulating them, but Bernanke's giving Wall Street a pass on some, Geithner is giving Wall Street a pass on some of them, some of the over-counter derivatives, i.e. the more complicated ones. They can still trade those among themselves. I think those exceptions should be, I think they should all be forced to trade over the counter. I mean, if you're asking me, basically, do I think the proposed regulations go far enough? My answer is no, I don't. I tend to be of the Paul Volcker view that we should consider an actual split up of the financial system, a sort of, not really a return to Glass-Steagall, but a sort of 21st century version of Glass-Steagall, where you'd have a safe financial sector which sort of oversaw consumer deposits, brokerage accounts, etc. That would be government guaranteed. If those companies got into trouble, there'd be a sort of explicit or semi-explicit government guarantee that they couldn't go bankrupt. But in return for that, they'd be heavily regulated. They'd have high capital requirements. They'd be regulated like a utility. So you'd have a utility banking system. Then on the other side, people like Goldman Sachs or whoever would say, well, we don't want anything to do with that. Fine. They could, what the people call casinos, the casino aspect of the banking system, they would be allowed to carry on, but there'd be an explicit sort of law saying there's no bailouts. You get into trouble, you're by yourselves. Now, it might not be credible, you're going to say. Well, no, I'm not going to say it's going to happen. It's probably not going to happen, no, but the question is whether it would be credible. I think it might be credible because the financial market, if people really believe they had a chance to go under, they'd be much more reluctant to lend them money. So Goldman and people would have trouble expanding their balance sheets in this way. It's not going to happen because of the lobbying power, obviously. But if you're asking me personally what I think should be done, I think we should sort of appoint Paul Volcker as the new Treasury Secretary. He's still in pretty good shape, and let him take over. Or else, I mean, going back to the previous question, you know, if it's Bernanke or somebody else, I'm in favour of Bernanke. If it's Bernanke or bring back Paul Volcker, I'll take Paul Volcker back. I don't think a lot of this would have happened if Volcker was still the Fed chairman. You need a bank. He's a banker, so he understood how these, you know, you need a thief to catch a thief sort of thing. He understood how banking works. You know, in the 1930s, we brought in Eccles, who ran a bank in Ohio and turned out to be one of the greatest Fed chairmen ever. So if they can find somebody like that, by all means, you know.
Arthur Levitt.
Possibly. you know, I think he's a bit, yeah, I mean, he'd be, he certainly wanted to consider. I have some reservations about his role as SEC chairman. But anyway, but if they could find somebody like that, I would agree. But as you say, realistically, that's not going to happen, I don't think. And with all the political impetus being on healthcare, I think we'll be lucky if we get any sort of financial regulation through early next year. So at this stage, I'm thinking, well, you know, if it's the Obama's, it's a bit like healthcare. If it's Obama's regulations or nothing, I'm in favour of Obama's regulations. Yeah, no, it's an interesting case, and actually, quite a lot of travelling around the country a bit to publicise this book. A lot of people have made that argument to me. What's happened to our manufacturing base? You know, we. I think the financial sector has got too big. Nobody's really said that in the US. In the UK, some very eminent people have made this argument, including the governor of the Bank of England and the head of the Financial Services Authority, that, you know, at some point the financial sector, rather than serving the rest of the economy, starts to sort of feed upon it. And I think we've got to that stage in some ways. The problem with it is, if I was Larry Summers, I would say, well, okay, you know, these guys maybe earn too much, but where's our competitive advantage these days? And he would argue that, you know, America's competitive advantage is in financial products and financial engineering, and that, you know, these banks do produce a lot of foreign earnings for the U.S., and to sort of, it's a mercantilist argument. So if we start really knocking down Wall Street, we'll just be giving competitive advantage to the Germans, the British, the Japanese, or whoever. I don't agree with that. But, you know, I think it underlies a lot of the reluctance of the administration to really get too tough with Wall Street. They say it's like, it used to be what's good for General Motors is good for America. Now it's what's good for Goldman Sachs is good for America. Well, not necessarily Goldman, because they're so unpopular, but, you know, what's good for JP Morgan Chase is good for America. Things won't come up. Yeah, I mean, there are some people. The argument, sorry, here is that the banks haven't actually dealt with the bad debt problem. They're still sitting on their balance sheets, so we're going to end up like Japan, presumably. That I think there's some very respected people who made that. I was on a panel with Carmen Reinhart the other night, who's an economist at Maryland, and she made this argument. I think there's something in that. Clearly, there was an accounting dodge earlier this year when they allowed them to not mark all these assets to market. But mark to market was having some pretty disastrous effects because it starts a downward spiral because you mark it to market, then they're short of capital, so they have to sell. Prices keep going down. You can get a downward spiral with mark to market. You need somewhere in between, maybe it's a temporary suspension of mark to market during the crisis and then reintroducing it. Why I'm not quite so pessimistic as sort of Carmen Reinhart, Paul Krugman and these people is I think the government's recapitalization of the banking system is actually proving quite effective. It's not a very pretty process to watch because all these guys who got us into the mess are now making big bonuses again. But the government, they don't say it out loud, but the Fed and the Treasury, their entire policy is based on allowing the banks to make big profits again, so they can rebuild their capital ratios, so they can then go out and lend to people, so we don't get another credit crisis, you know. And that's actually, they aren't lending again, but they are rebuilding their capital ratios quite effectively, largely due to monetary policy. They can borrow money from the Fed at 0%, excuse me, and then invest it in treasuries at 3.5%. That's why Bank of America can afford to repay the government, because the government's basically giving them the money, you know, it's a free thing. So, cut a long story short, I think the banking sector in the US will recover more rapidly than the Japanese banking sector, and that's why we won't have 10 years of Japanese problem. My worries are more on the other side, that it'll prove too successful and we'll get another bubble in something or another, because interest rates are too low and there's lots of free money running around. So I'm on the sort of inflation side of things rather than the deflation threat. Good question. The question is, what was the role of hedge funds in this? We haven't heard much of them since the long-term capital management crisis back in 1998. Right, the hedge funds just were not particularly active in subprime mortgage securities. They didn't have the distribution capacity. Some hedge funds, obviously, hedge funds, some of the credit hedge funds blew up because they were buying subprime. But they weren't, these products weren't distributed through the hedge funds. Now, does that mean hedge funds are, you know, are fine? No, I mean, I think what happened effectively is the Wall Street banks turned into hedge funds. I mean, I remember writing about long-term capital, and it was considered a great scandal at that stage that LTCM was geared 28 to 1, I think it was. Best Earns at the end of 2007 was geared like 35 to 1. Merrill Lynch was geared 30 to 1. These big Wall Street banks had effectively turned themselves into hedge funds. So there was a hedge fund crisis. They were just, you know, hedge funds disguised as investment banks, I think would be my answer. So, you know, I mean, leverage was the big problem. It just came about, you know, it came about in the inside of the financial system rather than on the peripheries.
So they weren't big customers?
No, they were big customers, but not enormous. I mean, the biggest buyers, ironically, of a lot of these securities turned out to be European banks because for some complicated regulatory reason, they didn't have to take big capital charges for buying subprime loans under the Basel capital rules. So that's why, it's always a bit of a mystery to me until I realized why, when the subprime market collapsed, did the first bank that went under was a German Landesbanken. And it's because it was financially in their interest to buy all these securities. So what was happening is Merrill Lynch, Goldman Sachs, whoever, were buying all these mortgages from Florida, California, wherever, turned them into securities, and then sending their salesmen off to Europe to sell them to German bankers. It was very clever, you know, and again, while it lasted, it was very lucrative. I think we're out of time, yeah, so thanks very much, everybody, for showing up.